Okay, everybody. We're going to have some more people coming in, but if folks could take your seats. These frameworks programs are usually fairly ambitious, but this one is really ambitious. All right. So, good morning. Good morning, and welcome to the Indiana Biosciences Research Institute. This is a really cool place to have one of these. This is the first time I've done this. We appreciate Reiner Fischer and the team here hosting us today, and it's a great place to talk about a great topic. We're going to talk today about diabetes and metabolic disease, which is what the IBRI is all about, and it's also what a number of the stakeholders that have put the Indiana Biosciences Research Institute are all about, and in some cases have been about for nearly 100 years. It's a good thing, because when it comes to diabetes, unfortunately, it is a disease that needs a tremendous amount of attention right here in the state of Indiana. As I think all of you probably know, Indiana is distinguished for our dismal public health statistics. We overall, in the epidemic diseases that constitute the crises in population health, behavioral health issues, cardiometabolic issues, we are either 38th or 39th out of the 50 states, and in many cases we are 44th or 45th. Obesity is one of those cases where we rank in at 44th out of 50 states. This is a competition where you want to be small numbers, not large ones. And diabetes is not all that far behind at 32 for our population. And it's a disease that afflicts our population across the board. It is not specialized in pockets. It does not confine itself to any particular ethnic group or economic standing. It is all across the board for our population. Roughly 10%, 8 to 10% of Hoosiers are afflicted by diabetes that we know. There are probably another 3 to 5% that have been undiagnosed that suffer from the disease and manifest symptoms. So that's the bad news, and obviously there's a lot of work to do in this area. There has been a lot of work to do in this area for a long time. This is a disease that used to kill people. It is now a disease that can be controlled if people pay attention to their condition and take their medications. And much of the medication and much of the diagnosing of this disease has been invented and started and carried out right here with the stakeholders that have, again, put together the Indiana Biosciences Research Institute and also are themselves innovators in the fields of diabetes care. You're going to hear from a number of powerful speakers on this today. This topic is so large that we did want to do it and inaugurate it in this framework session. I will give you a heads-up warning, those of you who come to our framework sessions. We like to keep these somewhat light and conversational and give all of you who are kind enough to show up here an opportunity to engage in Q&A with our speakers. We're going to try to make that happen again this morning, but we're also very committed to getting you out of here by 10 o'clock. We'll see which way this goes. But we have some really important things and important people to talk with you today. And I suspect this is a program, like some of the others we've done in this series before, that we will continue, probably do additional framework sessions in, and we're talking actively now about doing something more on the diabetes topic at the Indiana Life Sciences Summit in October, which is already well in preparations. So again, bear with us. We're going to try to move through a very big program and look forward to your participation as we bring our speakers here together at the end. So I'd like to start by welcoming Brad Moore, who is the head of Diabetes Care, North America, for Roche Diabetes Care here. He's going to provide some insights into Roche's diabetes strategy and new technologies that Roche is developing right here in Indianapolis to deal with this disease. Brad is responsible for all aspects of Roche's diabetes business in the U.S. and Canada, including the oversight of new product launches, marketing, finance, and customer support. Prior to joining Roche, Brad was Vice President of Health Systems Innovation at Johnson & Johnson. So, Brad, welcome. Come on up.
Thank you, David. Good morning, everyone. Pleasure to be here with you this morning and opportunity to share with you a little bit of some of the things that we're doing at Roche Diabetes Care. So I'll start with just a quick thumbnail sketch of Roche here in Indianapolis and globally. We're part of the Roche Group, which is a large pharmaceutical company, about 120-year history, founded in Basel, Switzerland, We have really two main parts of the business. About two-thirds of our business is in pharmaceuticals, and about a third is in diagnostics. What's interesting about that is that it really positions us very well for a future, and we're very committed to advancing personalized medicine. So the opportunity of leveraging companion diagnostics with therapies going forward is a very exciting opportunity for us. The diabetes care business is part of the diagnostics division. And this is our sort of global footprint, over 5,000 employees. We operate in about 150 markets worldwide. We have a couple of R&D centers, one of which is in Mannheim, Germany, and the other is here in Indianapolis. And here in Indy, the diabetes care business is co-located with our diagnostics business. And together, there are about 3,000 of us that work on the Indianapolis campus. About 1,000 of those are dedicated to diabetes care, and about half of those are actually in the manufacturing realm, where we operate the world's largest diabetes test strip manufacturing facility here in Indy. So just a quick tour through the history of our participation in helping to treat diabetes care. Our role has really been in glucose management and self-testing of glucose. And so it does go back to the 1980s. You can see these relatively rudimentary devices. Actually, the one at the bottom, the Freedom, was noted to be a portable system. Early ways and advances in being able to help people manage and test for glucose readings personally. The 1980s saw some real advances in the portability of the systems. And so through the 90s and into the 2000s, just successive innovations that allowed for better ease of use, shorter testing times, and also increased accuracy. And as we get now into our current flagship platform, which is the AccuCheck Guide system that we launched last year, also starting to integrate connectivity. So the devices have low energy Bluetooth, which allows for seamless connectivity into digital devices. And I'll talk more about that going forward. So just a couple notes about the market in which we operate today. I think some of the other speakers are going to go into more details on this, but suffice to say that diabetes is a condition that continues to increase in incidence and prevalence globally. We're approaching 500 million people that have the condition worldwide. And if you look at the chart on the right, this is a waterfall that was established that essentially shows that if you look at the number of people who are actually diagnosed, and that those who have access to care, and there's a quality care, and then how well controlled it is, you're really looking at 6% of the global population being actively treated and in control. So that's a huge opportunity and a huge amount of societal cost and personal cost to individuals if they're not able to effectively manage the condition. And so a lot of our efforts are certainly targeted at that 6%, but then moving our way back up the waterfall, we really can't solve all of the public health policy issues of the really big numbers, but certainly the next 20%. Is still a huge opportunity for us to provide tools that help people better manage their condition. And we go about that realizing that that really this is a self-managed condition. There's a very small fraction of people's lives are spent in contact with specialists that can help them on a day-to-day and moment-to-moment basis. And so it's really left to individuals to take on board all of the relevant information and to synthesize that to then make treatment decisions day in and day out, multiple times throughout the day. And there's a lot to take on board, and it's very difficult, it's time-consuming, and it's relentless. It never ends. And so it's really within this reality that we look for ways of innovating to make treatment more optimized, more seamless, and less of an imposition in people's lives. So this chart kind of depicts the optimal glycemic range. If you look at the green bar, the green horizontal bar, that's really the range that for normally functioning pancreas, kind of our bodies regulate that naturally. But for someone managing diabetes, it's a constant issue in trying to maintain within that range. And you can see there's a couple of points of information that people generally have at their disposal to make treatment decisions at any given point in time. Generally, that's lacking kind of the full picture. We get glucose readings, certainly. Doesn't always take on board nutrition, exercise, sleep, stress, all kinds of these issues that can then play into this. And so what ends up happening is you get a series of often under-treatment or over-treatment that leads to these excursions in and out of the glycemic range. And it's those excursions that can lead to either acute or very often then over time, cumulatively, long-term complications and issues. So, we're looking for ways of helping people to better stay within that range and to do it in such a way that it fits within their lives. So this is a depiction, obviously, of a much more in control kind of a paradigm where taking additional data points and putting those in people's hands in a usable fashion so that they can better manage in the moment, but also better understand from a trending perspective some predictability of what's to come as they're making therapy decisions in the moment. So looking ahead to some of the areas where we're looking to innovate to try to bring that last paradigm more into a reality. Our vision at Roche Diabetes Care is to innovate in ways that we can provide more integrated diabetes management. And so our heritage is really in providing devices that provide people with diabetes with a very important data point, which is their blood glucose levels. But what we're looking to do is to expand on that to also aggregate other data points into digitally enabled tools that allow for more seamless and better management. And so it takes into account a lot more of the factors that surround a patient in their daily management. So this is a kind of simplistic view that kind of depicts the paradigm of taking many disparate data points, whether that be around glucose levels, insulin doses, lifestyle factors, as I mentioned, exercise, stress, sleep levels, and also nutrition, and being able to consolidate that through the use of digital technology into actionable information that's at people's fingertips when they need it to make treatment decisions. Longer term, it's about using that information, that data, then to provide more predictability and to leverage down the road algorithms that can understand much more about that individual and also individuals like them to provide better information. I will say that the promise of big data and leveraging machine learning and that sort of thing, is a real opportunity. It's not something that we expect is going to pay huge dividends in the real near term. The information today is so fragmented in so many different pockets. It's going to take a while to really start to bring that together realize the big promise of big data. So actually, a lot of the wins in the near term are going to be more focused on what I'd consider small data. It's really just, you know, individual factors and variables for that person managing their condition that's going to allow them to do that more effectively and more seamlessly in their day-to-day lives. Over time, as the data becomes more available and becomes more integrated, we can realize some of the promise of big data. So a couple of points on how we're going about doing that. We recently established a partnership with Accenture to create a unified back end for all of our data needs globally. And so what Accenture is providing for us is a back-end data platform that allows us to compliantly, with the right data security measures, tie into a lot of disparate data sources and start to consolidate that so that individuals can use that their data, their healthcare providers can have appropriate access to that data, and then, as I say, long-term, providing for a data bank that can be interrogated for developing algorithms and more predictive tools. So this is a really important piece for us in just establishing that back end for data that comes from our devices, that comes from individuals, it comes from healthcare systems, and also partners that we look to work with. And then we're also investing in more front-end patient interface tools. And so we recently announced the acquisition of a company called MySugar, which has a diabetes management app that is actually, I think, the most widely used diabetes management app in the world, over a million registered users right now. It's a small company that was founded in Vienna, Austria. They also have some offices here in the U.S. And so this has been a very popular way for people to engage and consolidate their information, get the right insights and information on a day-to-day basis. And so this is certainly not the end point for us, but it's an important piece in starting to establish effective interfaces that engage people and make their lives easier. So to wrap up, hopefully you get a sense for the direction that we're heading in moving from being a device company that provides critical information to patients and starting to continue to innovate in the medical technology field and to provide better, more innovative solutions for people in monitoring their glucose, but also pulling that together in concert with digital technology to provide better management, better outcomes, and provide our patients with more relief. So with that, I'll thank you very much, and I'd like to pass it back to David. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate that. Brad, thank you. That was a really good presentation, a really good overview. Your slide on the 24/7 nature of diabetes and the extent of the disease is particularly sobering to get our discussion going here today. And again, those of you who work with BioCrossroads and follow what we do, we spend a lot of time talking about innovation. We spend a lot of time talking about risk-taking. We spend a lot of time talking about bold entrepreneurial endeavors, whether it's the Biosciences Research Institute here, and often a number of the startup companies that we invest in and CEOs and management teams that we urge on for success. And I think oftentimes in this market, and it's not restricted just to the life sciences, but particularly in this field, people think of innovation and aggressive risk-taking and embracing new challenges and all of the hallmarks of entrepreneurship and innovation is being something that happens primarily in the startup environment. It's something that happens with nimble, young biotechnology companies. In truth, and you've heard some of this just now from Brad, as Roche Diagnostics here embraces the challenges of moving from being not only a product company to being an information and data company, and that doesn't happen without taking bold, innovative risks and making lots of investments in big moves that are still remain to be proven. And similarly, in the talk you're about to hear, is another version of what happens in innovation. And when you decide you're going to be in the life sciences business, you've basically bought on to be a permanent innovator. You have to be at doing the same things that startup innovators do day in and day out, year in and year out, with larger and larger organizations. If you're a publicly traded company, that puts additional burdens in it. And yet the things that need to happen, the looking at risk, the embracing of challenge, the understanding of change, and the determination to forge new relationships, new partnerships, make new things happen, to put yourself at the top of the competitive heap, that is something that requires entrepreneurial and innovative skills of absolutely the first order. The person you're going to hear from here this morning has those skills in abundance. Eli Lilly and Company's diabetes franchise is nearly a century old. Lilly got to be a leader in this field in the therapeutic area by being really good, by taking really big risks early on, by deciding that diabetes was something that they could not only a disease that they could not only approach, but that insulin was an area that they could really end up being successful in, manufacturing, participating in, and really dominating a world market. But it is obviously, it's an epidemic disease. It's a disease which has only grown over time. With epidemic diseases come epidemic competitions as well. And so for Lilly to stay where it has stayed and in fact, in this case, to return to leadership with its diabetes franchise has taken bolder and bolder moves, nimbler and nimbler leadership, and some really, really aggressive risk-taking, successful aggressive risk-taking. We thought it would be very important for you here today to hear this story, not only from the standpoint of diabetes care, but the standpoint of what it takes for the stakeholders that make up this life sciences economy to be continuously innovating every day to make really big things happen. Our speaker today is Enrique Quinterno. Enrique is the Senior Vice President of Eli Lilly and Company. He's the President of Lilly Diabetes and the President of Lilly USA. My notes say there are two jobs in that. It sounds to me like there are three, but in any event, Enrique is a very, very busy guy. And Enrique is really the guy who has led the Lilly Diabetes organization from a position of strength to a position of really preeminence and greatness over the past few years. So, Enrique, we'd appreciate hearing your story.
Thanks. Welcome. David, thank you for the introduction and the very generous comments. I always say when I hear those, I said, I wish my parents were invited, you know? My dad would actually, my mom would actually believe you. Anyways, it's great to be here. I do have a script, but given the format, I'm just going to very loosely follow it, okay? But great to be here with so many friends and colleagues in this growing and vibrant life sciences community here in Indianapolis. It's great to see and great that we are basically addressing such an important topic as the topic of diabetes. I won't go through the numbers of diabetes. What I wanted to sort of do this morning is basically take you through the Lilly journey. And I want to go to the very beginning as we think about that journey, because for me, it has been a source of inspiration as we think about risk-taking and bold decisions. And it all started in 1921. In fact, Christmas morning in 1921, the top Lilly scientist at that time decided that he was going to take a train bound to New Haven, Connecticut, to hear this talk. And I'll be honest, if you look at the research papers and the understanding at that time, and given how many false positives or false alarms have been around finding a cure for diabetes, I'm surprised that he took the train and that he did not decide to delay that, but he went to the talk, and after all of it was said and done, he basically sent a famous words that we talk about at Lilly, which is, this is it. He sent the telegraph back and said, this is it. And I'm also surprised because we know what the talk was about, and I'm so surprised that he was so bullish. The reality is that while he was bullish, it took Lilly quite a bit of time to basically get the confidence of the Toronto investigators for us to be able to develop that partnership. In fact, there was a lot of tenacity, and there was a lot of convincing. And for some of you that work in large companies, there's a lot of convincing that you have to do externally, but sometimes a lot of convincing that you also have to do internally. And both of those were happening at Lilly because this is post-World War I. It was not like we had abundance of resources, but Lilly decided to make the investment at that time and to basically really create the manufacturing process to be able to commercialize insulin in large scale and be able to reach patients. Just as an anecdote, insulin was in such a desperate need at that time that people actually, whenever we were producing the insulin vials very early on, they actually knew the actual patient that insulin vial was going to go for, and they would write those names on the bottles. In the early times, Lilly was supporting about 10,000 patients with diabetes, most of them young children, which before insulin was introduced, basically would go on to what's called the Allen starvation diet, which was a way to slow down the metabolism and try to make sure that people could actually live longer. But it was really a death sentence to be diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at that time. As I think about the lesson at that time, and when I say the inspiration is, wow, and the commitment to go on Christmas morning, the fact that you look at what he had, and he had to do what we call a leap of faith, and quite frankly, a lot of tenacity. There were a lot of naysayers when it comes to should this be the right, you know, investment. But George Alec Clues basically forged ahead at that time and decided that this was the right investment for Lilly. And we've been in this business now for almost 100 years. Now, fast forward to 2018, where we continued to manufacture insulin. The reality is we were the first company to develop the first insulin coming from biotechnology. So the very first company to introduce a biotech product in the United States was Lilly. It was human insulin. And then we people got creative, and we even developed insulin analogs. So how can you get better than just human insulin, which is identical to the insulin that we have in the body? Well, the reality is one thing is to have endogenous insulin. A different one is when you're injecting the insulin, by modifying it slightly, it could better mimic the endogenous insulin and its effects. So Lilly was able to introduce the first insulin analog, and we're very proud of it. Now, David talked about, okay, we have this great history. You know, we talk about, you know, Lilly being a preeminent company. The reality is, and some of you might be more aware than others, but Lilly decided to basically focus on other therapeutic areas other than diabetes for a period of time in the 1990s. And that involved everything from research to our commercialization. So through the late 1990s to the early 2000s, basically our focus was really neuroscience. There are a number of reasons, and you hear a number of stories where we made some of those calls. I was just an associate at that time at Lilly, so but I clearly insulin and diabetes in general takes a long-term view, and when you look at it from that perspective, it is indeed a great business and proved that it can be. In 2009, Lilly decided to basically reorganize our pharmaceutical operations, and we created three, really four, but three therapeutic business units, one of them being diabetes, one of them being oncology, and the other one biomedicines, which is just really the rest, okay? And I was head of U.S. operations at that time, and I was asked, hey, Enrique, you know, how about if you take this diabetes role? Of course, by that time, Lilly had renewed that commitment to diabetes, but the reality is it was difficult to get an aligned plan across the enterprise for us to move forward with agility, speed. We had a saying, which is there was always some executive that could say no, and we wanted to get rid of that, and we wanted to basically have full accountability. So I took the challenge at that time. I'm pleased that I did. We had a great run. I'll be honest, I'm probably giving a lot more credit than I deserve, because we got a few breaks, and Mary King is here, and others that helped pave the way for some of our innovation. One of the big moves that we first made at that time was, it was pretty clear, because we had not invested enough in research, that we had to enter into a partnership to accelerate bringing innovation to market. We already had a partnership with Amylin, and I entered into a second partnership with Boehringer Ingelheim, different from Boehringer Mannheim, that is part of Roche's history. But we decided that this partnership would give us access to two great oral products, and it was something that for us, and we saw it as just very complementary to our portfolio. But our first partner did not see it the same way. Okay, and in fact, for a few weeks, I had an injunction against our operations, our commercial operations, where we couldn't commercialize the products from my new partner. You can imagine, we're launching products, and we got that lifted. Partner basically sued us, and it was, I think for many, it was a pretty tense time, but the inspiration, right, was that I really believed in the partnership that we had just created and the innovation that we had, and we thought it was worthwhile for us to go through that. Eventually, we sold the business back to Amylin, the rights back to our business, and it gave us an additional benefit that we were commercializing with them what we call a GLP-1, and the great benefit for us was that now we could take to market Trulicity, which is now Lilly's fastest growing product and expected to be Lilly's largest product this year. So very exciting for us to see that benefit. I think the lesson for us is just to really believe in the innovation. We didn't have all of the answers at that time, but the partnership with Boehringer Ingelheim gave us something very unique. It gave us the very first product in diabetes to be able to show a reduction of risk in cardiovascular death for people with type 2 diabetes. That had never been done before. So we got that indication, and it cut the risk of cardiovascular death for people with type 2 diabetes and established cardiovascular disease by 38%. And you got to keep in mind, these people were already on top of statins. They were basically getting the standard of care when it comes to dealing with cardiovascular disease. So this reduction is on top of that. We were blown away when I received this call. I was in my office. it was Robert Heine that called me from Germany. And I said, Robert, I said, I know you've seen a lot of data over the years, but you might be a little bit overexcited. Are you sure that this is the right data? He goes, Enrique, I've questioned that myself. And before calling you, I had to rethink what am I going to tell you, because it's pretty incredible what we're seeing. So we got from that partnership, we got that the product is Jardiance. It's doing incredibly well, and the prospects of it are incredible as we look at the future. And then we also, of course, have Trulicity, which is our fastest growing product, has done better than maybe even we internally thought. And we've focused on basically just creating a much larger halo over the entire class, and taking the high road, which really paid for us in a really big way. Brad spoke to something that is really interesting, which I wanted to touch on, which is something that we haven't discussed much, but we announced it in November. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal. We got an interview where we talked about our what we called our connected care ecosystem, which Lilly has been making pretty significant investments to basically develop integrated solutions, both automated solutions. So think of you have insulin, and whether it's a pen or a pump, you have a sensor or something that either a blood glucose monitor or a continuous glucose monitor. And then you basically have smart algorithms, which provide clinic support. And they can either make a recommendation or take a step or deliver insulin for a patient in an automatic fashion, or it can make a recommendation for that patient on in terms of what to do. Now, I don't think that this is far away, or big data. This is something that I think is here, and we're testing it. It works. So to me, I think this is the future, because imagine now we're going to have basically a patient that is going to have in real time, we will be able to see their integrated data, maybe a recommendation. Physicians, providers will be able to have the information about the patient, blood glucose and insulin dosing in real time, and so do integrated health systems. So this is extremely powerful, and of course the data is going to be presented differently for a patient versus a healthcare provider versus maybe a payer or an integrated health system. So very exciting for us, but it's new too. It's that really the convergence of, we call it tech and therapeutics, and basically bringing solution for people with diabetes. I'm pretty excited about that bet. We are also developing other products, whether it's nasal glucagon, the very first non-injectable glucagon that we are planning to also bring into the market in 2019. And we have also an ultra-rapid insulin in development. Now, you're going to hear a lot this year when it comes to Lilly Diabetes that we have a lot of competition, and we do. It is probably the most significant year from a competitive perspective. We have more competitors entering 2018 that we've ever had. So new, either all competitors with new products. So Trulicity will get a pretty formidable competitor. Sanofi is launching a follow-on insulin, which is structurally similar to Humalog, our best-selling insulin today. And I read the analysts' reports. I learn from what they say, and we of course follow our competitor, and we take them pretty seriously. At the end of the day, I think we are extremely well prepared at Lilly when it comes to addressing the competitors. But in addition to that, at the end of the day, we also have to deliver the next wave of innovation. That's what we are very much working on. I'm going to ask now, we're going to transition. I'm going to we are going to go into a quick chat. I'm going to invite Dara Schuster and David Kendall to join me, and we are basically going to take I'm going to ask him a few questions.
He really is going off script on this, I'll just tell you.
So I work closely, of course, with Dara and David. I had the pleasure, actually, another learning for me is you got to hire great people, right? And I had a chance to actually hire both of them at Lilly. I remember my interview with Dara, and she was a professor at Ohio State University. She's an endocrinologist, and she had a number of leadership roles at Lilly, and now most recently, she's basically the head of medical for our medical affairs for diabetes in the U.S. market. So, Dara, maybe the question for you would be, you know, if you could just provide maybe a synopsis of current trends when it comes to diabetes in the U.S.
Yeah, thank you, Enrique, and thanks for giving us the opportunity to be here, meet you, and talk about how we can partner together. But I think some of the biggest trends in the U.S. are the fact that we lead in terms of diabetes research and in diabetes treatment and therapy. And as such, we're responsible for a lot of research, setting the standards of care, and really understanding it. That being said, we're also very affected by this disease, with 30 million adults in the United States having diabetes, 12% of our population. So some of the things that we are working on with regards to our research, I think both Brad and Enrique alluded to, connected care and really developing medications that are safe and effective, that are easy to use for patients, because the disease just becomes more and more challenging. And we continue to make great medicines, but now we also have to think about how to deliver that care. And so in addition to the work that we do with regards to just medication development, we really have to think about our bigger ecosystem, which is why we sit in rooms with people like you to talk about how do we deliver this healthcare effectively so that we can improve outcomes. And I think the bottom line for all of us is, are our societies healthier? Are they getting the medicines they need, and do healthcare providers have the tools and resources to get the job done? So I think that's probably as big a push, Enrique, as medication innovation. I would say that both of them are right now running parallel and where we need to do to accomplish this.
Yeah. Brad alluded to this, and I don't recall if the numbers were global or just U.S. numbers, but this rule of 50s, as it's called, where you go from being, you know, old people with diabetes to the people that are diagnosed, the people that don't have access, limited access, and then basically going to the people that truly comply. And in the U.S. right now, I think there's been a revolution when it comes to treatments, but compliance is still very low, right? So anything that we could do around compliance,
I think
is right. It's extremely important. David is a distinguished medical fellow at Lilly. We have only a few of those at Lilly. I can count them on one hand. Among all of our scientists and clinicians that basically hold that type of distinction. David has had a illustrious career when it comes to the field of diabetes. He was the chief scientific officer for the American Diabetes Association. He worked at Amylin, which is a company that sued us, but before they sued us. Also worked at the International Diabetes Center in Minneapolis. By the way, differently from Indianapolis, Minneapolis, one of the characteristics of that city is that they basically have some of the highest health scores. And in fact, we took not too long ago the Indy Chamber. We visited that Minneapolis and St. Paul to learn a bit about, okay, how is it that you think longer term about a city and the planning, you know, to ensure that we're promoting health and so forth. But David, you have quite a broad view. I thought that I would ask you, not U.S., but more global trends when it comes to diabetes, and what could you tell us?
Well, I think, thank you, Enrique, and pleasure to be here. Brad did a very nice job at outlining the current scope of the challenge that faces the diabetes community and, in fact, for other chronic health conditions. Dara flashed a quick map that shows what the diabetes belt looks like in the U.S. Some of the statistics that Brad talked about are not just sobering, but if one looks at the picture behind me, diabetes, probably along with obesity, is one of the few chronic health conditions where we historically underestimate the future risk. These numbers are updated every 3 to 5 years. The Centers for Disease Control here in the U.S., the International Diabetes Federation and its atlas, and the rule of 50s is in fact amplified as you leave major metropolitan centers and established health systems. So Enrique talked briefly about type 1 diabetes being a fatal disease. That still exists in certain parts of the world. In Eastern Africa, the average lifespan of a child with type 1 diabetes is on the order of 1.5 to 2 years. Whereas in the U.S., lifespan of individuals living with type 1 diabetes is now approaching that of individuals not living with diabetes. So there is great disparity around the globe. The other thing that is happening, despite all of the advances that Enrique talked about and that many of us have had the pleasure of being part of the first EcuCheck Freedom, if I believe, the 1982 device was the first one I saw when I was in the research lab. It was the size of a suitcase. But those changes are not yet permeating major geographies around the world. That is, as you get to lower middle socioeconomic status or income countries and the lowest income countries, the rates of undiagnosed diabetes go up, the rates of obesity are increasing, urbanization is increasing. So it's not simply a challenge, as Dara described, of getting the tools to the individuals in established healthcare systems. That is a great challenge in and of itself, but it's making a small dent in this next 20% in major geographies. If you will, think about China as an example. China has a population living with diabetes of about 125 million people. That would be like one in every three individuals here in the U.S. having diabetes. They are not ready for this. This is a society that urbanized very quickly, and the effects will be longstanding. How do we translate some of the learnings across the healthcare systems here? And I'll close with a global fact that came out of U.S. data, but as was described by Brad, this is an equal opportunity risk. Both type 1 and type 2 diabetes occur around the globe. But data presented now almost 2 decades ago by the Centers for Disease Control suggested that if a child was born in the year 2000 in the U.S. and current trends with obesity and health delivery continued, one in every three individuals would develop diabetes in their lifetime. And if you were in a high-risk population group, Native American, African American, Latino, Latina, the risk was 1 in 2. That means every other child born in the year 2000 will develop diabetes in their lifetime. And we're seeing that come true in some ways. Patients over the age of 65 in the U.S. now, the rates of diabetes are about 1 in 4. That is, every fourth patient seen in the geriatrics population, if you will, is affected by diabetes. So that gives you some idea of the scope of the problem. Enrique talked about this. He sent me off to a little mini business school a couple of years ago. I don't know finance at all, so I'll call on the folks who do. But delivering diabetes care to me is akin to finance in the 1970s, where we all had checkbooks and had written ledgers and had to go to the bank to check on our balance and our loans, and all of this was done in person. How many of you have been to a bank in the last 48 hours? How many of you have paid a written bill in the last week or month? But as Brad showed, diabetes is something we care for in essentially a rudimentary fashion. We haven't yet integrated the data, but we're coming very close with Enrique and his leadership. I think these connected cares will take us in diabetes where a lot of the electronics in the financial world have taken us, so that we can take control of how we manage or help people manage the assets or challenges given to them. So Enrique, a long answer to a simple global question.
Very good. Now, thank you very much to, thank you, David. Thank you, Dara. I believe now we are going to transition to the part of the program where we're going to have a full panel. So I'm going to invite David Rayner and Brad to join for this panel discussion.
Thank you. Enrique, very much. That's a terrific presentation. I think we're going to ask Dr. Fisher here, Rainer, before you sit down, I think we're going to make you work.
Really?
Yep. We'd also like to hear from Dr. Rainer Fisher to put the perspective of the Biosciences Research Institute into this conversation. Again, this institute was formed by Lilly, by Roche, by Cook, and by others that were very focused on, in particular, diabetes, obesity, and cardiometabolic disease. The reasons for that, I think, are quite clear in terms of the stakes and what you've just heard. And I want to walk through several questions on innovation with the panel, but again, to be sure that we've got the stage fully set, Rainer, would you come up and just give a brief perspective from the IBRI?
Yes. Yeah, thank you, David.
Thank you.
I think I'm going to go here. I don't like this. It's hiding behind the wall. So I'm the new kid on the block with the IBRI. So you can ask yourself, what are these guys doing here after almost 100 years being in diabetes research and providing solutions, both from the diagnostic and particularly therapeutic field? So what I would like to share with you, what has been built based on a recommendation of a report from BioCrossroad in 2012 to establish an independent research institute, a 501c3 organization that helps to bridge innovation between different partners from academia and industry. And that is in the end the mandate of the IBRI to reach out, to bridge, to connect, and in particular in the cardiometabolic and nutrition field. So I would like to walk you through a few things that we've done. You know the Indiana network with all the different players from therapeutics over diagnostics, but also the providers and in particular academia with Purdue, IU, Notre Dame and a few other players, but also the life science and the IT entrepreneurs and the IT space and the government organizations, including CICP that we have here, which is a wonderful organization, bringing all the stakeholders on a regular basis together. And I remember when I came first around over 10 years ago to Indianapolis working with the Dow, I saw this BioCrossroad sign at the Indianapolis airport. And I was always wondering, what is this about? I think you guys still have to improve a little bit on the advertisement there. But it's a good eye catcher, and we really need to build on this a little bit better in the future. Now, we thought we can maybe place the IBRI in the middle of this spider web and try to attract not praise, but really partners, and really develop innovative ideas to the next technology readiness level to add value, but also hopefully innovative solutions to the local, the national community, and ultimately to the globe, as we heard. So this is a little bit of a complex model of what we have set out to do in the middle. Enrique, I hope I'm not going to kill you with a German laser here. It's a high-power Fraunhofer green laser. Anyway, so we have the IBRI in the center, connecting academic and industry partners. And the important thing is to do this along the technology readiness level. So this was introduced around almost 20 years ago by NASA, thinking about how can we take an innovative idea to the market and really make it a success story. And if you see, academia is at the beginning, excuse me, at TRL 1 and 2, And IBRI literally will bridge this with industry partner to go into translational research, similar like what the CTSI is doing, and they are a partner of ours, and ultimately how to really connect early on with industry, not to repeat the mistakes, and really also address regulatory issues very early on. And ultimately, how can we pay for that? So this will be through endowment that has been established that will grow, but also through public grants and in particular industry collaboration. And that is exactly what I did over the last 20 years, almost in Germany. You see, we also have some German links, not only the Boehringers, but also we. And my other link to diabetes is I actually postdoc with Art Riggs, and he's the gentleman that cloned the gene for the human insulin. Okay? Good. Now, why focus on metabolic diseases and nutrition? I think we heard that. But I think the important number is really, if you look globally, and that's the number from the WHO, first of all, it doubled in the last 25 years, and we're now at 8.5% globally. But you heard US is even higher, above 10%. And if you go to China, and in particular also to some of the North African countries, they're far beyond 20%. And more shocking even are the latest numbers from the CDC from November last year for obesity. It is now approaching 38%. And the question is, what can we do together, even with a new kid on the block, to help coming up with some innovative solutions? So what we have set out, we have put together a team here at IBRI, together with Teresa Mastracci, in regenerative medicine, addressing beta cells, particularly in the context of type 1 diabetes. Then in the diagnostic space, particularly single cell analytics, with a gentleman called Mike Puccia, former Siemens employee, and he has developed 21 diagnostic products that he brought or helped bring to the market. And most recently, last year in July, we hired Dan Robertson from former Lilly in the applied data sciences. And that's what I'm going to quickly focus on, and then I will pass on to to Dan for a few seconds to talk about. So in the end, we are interested really in a holistic view, what impacts health, and in particular here now in diabetes, and in particular having access to the electronic medical records that have been actually established initially here in the state of Indiana. So really not only having data, small data, big data, smart data, I like that expression, really, really good, but really how to address real-world data from patients. Now, there's a lot of data out there, but many of them are not useful. And so we have thought about how can we basically, from a basic research perspective, with all the different tools and assays that are out there, technologies, address this and bring the data in, but also how to see this with the external factors. And we heard of them. And in the end, all of the lifestyle, nutritional factors play a very, very important role, also behavior. And that's what we try to bring together in the group of Dan Robertson in this interaction. And what I would like to do now is pass on to Dan to maybe give you one of these examples, what we have been working on over the last 12 months and what data came out of that. Dan?
Thanks, Rainer, and thank you all for here. I'm just going to make a couple brief comments to reinforce what the panelists are saying in terms of this relative to IBRI. A couple key things to note. We in Indiana, when you have to look across this, have a history of innovation. Enrique talked about first commercial insulin. Brad didn't really mention going back to the first point-of-care diagnostics from Roche in terms of this. As we go forward, it is how do we also look at the data, socioeconomic, the other data, the environment, the digital connected devices coming forward. So we here at IBRI have understood that you actually have to connect not only the organizations who have the data, but also the data sources themselves and be at that forefront in terms of that. So in the data sciences, as we look to the future of machine learning, as we look to data, smart data, right data, the personalized data of the individuals, the population health, how do you do that? We need to break through some of those barriers in terms of doing that. Here at IBRI, we've been working in terms of doing that and showing that as applied not-for-profit, you can actually break through some of those barriers to do those that you may not be able to do individually, but still leveraging the ecosystem, the resources, the talent that we have here. So what I'm going to talk to is just two key things, projects that we've done in terms of doing that as pilots here. The first one was thanks to the one other piece of innovation that I want to say is that I was going to add was we also are the place where the first electronic medical records were created with Regan Street. Actually, in 1972, Clem McDonald actually generated from Regan Street the first electronic medical records, and no surprise, actually done at Wishart in low poverty individuals to try and help them with diabetes and manage it. Since that time, Regan's Reef has continued to expand the resources that that has. That's critical for the environment and what we do in the future, real data. It's also critical because about 10 years ago, a little more than that, the Indiana Health Information Exchange was created locally to improve healthcare and transfer of information between patients. Using those, we now have a regional state database that has a lot of data. The pilot I did with the State Department of Health, we actually leveraged data from the Indiana Health Information Exchange as well as IU Health to look at obesity rates here within Central Indiana with the State Department of Health. Most recently now, we're working with both our partners on the stage in terms of Eli Lilly, Roche Diagnostics, where we've accessed data, 2 million patients, 20 years, 2 billion records of those. We're looking at type 2 diabetes and complications thereof. We're now at the point where we've cleaned it, we've generated that. We're working with our partners to deliver those. And now getting to the point where we've actually done work with Roche Diabetes Care to actually validate a predictive model that they have on real-world data in terms of that saying, when you get type 2 diabetes, the issues are complications. What's your probability of getting diabetes within or chronic kidney disease upon first diagnosis of type 2 diabetes? That paper has now been generated. It's in press publication. We've been able to validate that. We will be moving into this area where we now are driving innovation, machine learning, AI, the right data, the right patient population, the connected devices, the IoT of health and medical. And we at IVRI think that, yes, we have a huge amount of substrate capabilities here from our academic, industrial, but then we can help bridge the gap to drive innovation. And so at this point, I'll push it back to Reiner to talk about where we're going.
Okay. Thank you, Dan. So you see, we're trying to take a slightly different approach. We are not going to generate all the data. We embark on data already existing, but also we take the effort to polish them, to make them more suitable, usable. And in the end, it really doesn't matter whether it's small, big data, smart data. I think we all need to work together and really compile the data and make them usable in the context of these different diseases. And ultimately, I think this will have a major impact. Basically, it's the next medical revolution. And I think the great thing that you guys have here in Indianapolis is the proximity of all the people, but it's now the corporate partners, Lilly, Roche, but we also have the nutrition partners, whether it's Mead Johnson, starting with baby food, by the way, and on top we have Dow, DuPont, so big partner of mine in the past over the last 20 years, but also don't forget about the IT companies, huge impact, huge opportunities, and I can only appeal, let's work together and make this happen. It's a big challenge. What I used to do in my previous job, travel a million miles a year for almost 20 years, literally everything is more or less in a very small ecosystem. But please don't forget, it's not only about Indiana or the Indianapolis, Indiana, but also the nation and ultimately globally, because it's a global issue, maybe even a lifestyle kind of issue, and the compliance is a very, very important element. I think I'm going to stop here, also because of time reasons, and we're going to enter then, I think, into the discussion.
Reiner, thank you very much. I think, let me see if I can do this. It's a lot of us up here. Let me see if I can take a seat. Reiner, just one additional question for you on the IBRI. You all have recently received a grant from the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. That's on type 1 diabetes. How does that research factor into what you're talking about here?
I think that's a very important additional element to consider, not only the type 2, and I'm very happy that, first of all, we particular Teresa with her grant application, she's sitting in the back. Maybe she can say two, three words about that, that she received this fund and the support from the JDRF, and also was considered based on her achievements. Maybe, Teresa, you can just say two, three words about where we stand for this and where we want to take this next. Teresa.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Teresa. So I think what I can supplement, this is a perfect example by reaching out to IU. So Teresa used to be in Raghu Mamira's lab, bringing her over and getting her settled here, and we will heavily support that over the next 5 years, this program. And ultimately, this could lead to a solution maybe in 10, 15 years. We're not ready for that because this is very early on, maybe also in combination with advanced stem cell research or using the next generation of genome engineering or genome editing technologies to be applied in this field. There are some first reports, but there are no solutions, and that will take at least another 10 years to move this forward, and there we will definitely need the help of the local stakeholders, whether it's from academia and particularly from corporate partners.
I appreciate that. Which is an observation, juvenile diabetes used to mean the same thing as type 1 diabetes. I think increasingly we're seeing a lot of juveniles with type 2 diabetes as well, and the epidemic that we're all confronting here. So it's an amazing set of developments. And Ricky and Brett, I want to ask you both the same question, and it's really stimulated by the comments you made here this morning. Bear with me as I try to do that. You know, when the Bioscience Research Institute here was formed, and formed by all of you, and we were fortunate enough to recruit Reiner to come in to run things, the very first, when everybody got together and decided, okay, this place has got to have some basic core research, and I think people thought, was it going to be in biology? Is it going to be in chemistry? It was in data. So the very first thing that was done here was to put together the data analytics core that Dan Robertson has just talked about. Both your talks, if I'm following your connected care concepts, I think I am, and Brad, what I know you guys are trying to do with DIS and diagnostic solutions, you're both from a diagnostic company, one from a therapeutic company, you're also both moving into data, the use, more effective use of data as the key to whatever your innovation future is. How do you make money on that? I mean, how does something like connected care, or, and I'll ask you that first, Enrique, and then Brad, you follow, on your business model with again beginning to take the information, massive amounts of information you folks are getting in all this, how do you monetize that to be around long enough to see all these pieces come together? Yeah. Enrique?
So the way we think about it is rather than maybe selling a pen or a vial of insulin like we do today, in the future we're going to be basically commercializing a system. So you will basically get a system that has been optimized and designed to give you the best experience possible.
I as the patient would,
correct,
would get that. Okay.
Today, you know, what patients do, they actually buy, they actually get components from different companies, and they basically put those together. I can tell you it's very suboptimally. And so we think that we can improve the experience quite a bit. Now, part of the revolution here is really, and in the case of insulin, every single patient is different. They may require a different dose. Clearly, there's some general patterns. So the software or the clinical support or the algorithms, so Lilly actually bought people don't know this, but we actually bought an algorithm company despite all the clinical data that we have and so forth. we actually looked at really what we were buying really was much more the intellectual property. How do we basically have the right algorithm so that they provide the right thing for the patient at the right time? And importantly, through machine learning, how does it learn over time what your specific and predict what your specific patterns are and basically provide you excellent support? Now, some of you may say, wow, does Lilly have all those capabilities? And some of you may say, think that we do. We do not. We don't have all of those capabilities. So we partner to think about, and in some cases we purchased, to think about how do we put all of this together. Clearly, we are already actually having discussions with payers on, and I can tell you the most important part for them is the data.
The data, right.
Not just the system, which is what we offer, but the data. And of course, we haven't decided on how we're going to commercialize that, but there's no question that the data has huge value, whether it's decreased pharmacy resources or just better outcomes, better control. If you look at any integrated health system, and I would challenge because some people here might be in something, well, we don't. I would be extremely surprised if when you look at a patient with diabetes, more than 25% of them actually have blood glucose measurements on their records. Okay? And I can, we work with a number of companies. It's very rare the companies, the integrated health system that have, that are above 25%. So we're going to basically have 100% of patients using the system will basically be able to have a full history and a full understanding of where they are when it comes to diabetes control. I think it can be pretty powerful.
Certainly sounds like it. Brad, what's your take on this?
Sure. So I would say a pretty consistent view with what Enrique just laid out. And you know, for us, a lot of us thinking about pivoting from providing devices only to more providing solutions. And when you talk about solutions, you know, it could be a combination of devices, could be therapies, could be services, but it's essentially in the interest of providing a certain result or outcome for that customer. Could be a patient, could be a health system, could be a payer. The bottom line is right now that pivot to different business models is really challenging. With a device or a medicine, it's not always easy, but it's at least straightforward to understand how you get paid for that. When you start talking about delivering a certain outcome, you know, this is all in the context of, I would say, what's happening in our healthcare systems. If you take the U.S. right now, kind of a pretty acute change ongoing right now in the shift from fee-for-service type healthcare delivery to more value-based. And, you know, I've spent the past several years talking to a lot of leaders at payers and healthcare systems, and that transition is actually very, very painful. Because all of the infrastructure, the processes, the budgets are really aligned around fee-for-service medicine, and it's very difficult for those in the healthcare delivery side to have one foot on the dock and one foot on the canoe as they're moving out into value-based medicine. So it's going to be it's going to happen over time, but I think that our opportunity is, as we look to monetizing solutions as we've tried to provide value, one part is to anchor it to an actual physical product like a device or a medicine. But also keeping it in the context of where the incentives are for our customers. Mm-hmm. And right now, you know, that means, I think, you know, targeting more acute aspects, things that can show a return on investment for that customer in, say, a year or less, mm-hmm. Because that allows them to sort of manage this transition. Ultimately, I think we'd love to get to a point where you're investing a lot more of healthcare dollars into more prevention or into preventative type care, but we're not quite there yet. So I think it's going to be starting with mitigating things like hospitalizations, ER visits, very tangible things that can drive a return on investment, and then, you know, start working our way more into some of the more wellness and prevention areas.
Makes sense. And Enrique, one additional question for you and your team, then we're going to open this up for some questions. We're going to have time to do that. You talked in your talk about innovation in the therapeutic area of insulin, and you noted that starting with Humulin and Humalog, that Lilly and others have been able to make some basic improvements on insulin itself, or at least in outside insulin to make a bigger difference. Is there any, in other areas, I'm going to rapidly betray my lack of scientific skill here, so bear with me on it, but in other biologics fields, you hear about gene editing, you hear about, all kinds of different ways of approaching the needs for therapies and really trying to change the equation within the human body to perhaps just change the whole disease. Is there anything going on in diabetes research like that, or is that just not a productive exercise or productive area? Because it seems like the basics, insulin, is kind of what we've had. It's what we know we need. It's what we've had for 100 years. And even though we've improved it, it's still sort of the same thing.
I'm sure there are better people that can answer this question than I can. But there is research going on when it comes to gene editing or, it's... I really believe this is going to be a big part of the future when it comes to diabetes and other areas, but I'm skeptical in terms of how quickly will it come.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the studies right now have been done in really mice, and whether it's to modify some of the genes, basically producing GLP-1s, but it's. I think it's going to be honestly a long road. David, you might be able to help me here.
Yeah, it's. I'm excited to hear about the work that's going on here. I started my career in 1982 in the islet transplantation field, and that was giving functional islet cells, which contain the insulin, the glucagon, and other hormone-producing cells, back to individuals who'd lost them. About 15 years later, I decided to make a little sidestep back to the care of diabetes rather than the cure of diabetes. So while I do believe there are regenerative medicine efforts to control what is an immune response in type 2 diabetes or type 1 diabetes, what is probably a very complex polygenic disease in type 2 diabetes, poorly functioning islet cells with a body that just doesn't behave the same given our environmental construct of, calories everywhere, energy expended nowhere. It's true. I mean, you take someone from East Africa and you put them in Indianapolis, they take the bus, they've got food everywhere, and they were not made for that. So the constructs are going to be very complex. I think it, in the near term, ties back to continuing projects. If you can cure zebrafish, maybe we can make some steps there. But in the near term, it's, for me, care, not cure. And the more we use these integrated systems, I think the closer we come to optimized care. I'm going to put in one plug for Minnesota, which followed on. Dan knows this. Community measurement has been a huge issue in Minnesota, meaning public reporting of outcomes from clinic systems for things like heart failure, asthma, and diabetes. It's called the D5 in Minnesota. So every patient, every provider knew how their clinic was doing in sort of a general sense of public reporting. For anyone who's interested, the D5.org in Minnesota, you can see how they stack up against one another. And I will tell you that, Dan, the power of data and public reporting made a huge difference. The institute I worked in once received a national award, and our CEO got up and said, thank you. We have about 20% of our patients to target, as Enrique said, so we are the cream of the crop, meaning we were the best of the worst in terms of a health system, but the challenge still remains how we take those data, innovations in gene therapy, and to Dara's and Brad's point earlier, integrate data in a meaningful way like my bank does for me.
Right. Thank you. That's just really, really helpful. We're going to lose Reiner here in a moment because I know he's got another appointment coming in, but we do have time for a few questions from the audience. So anybody have anything for our panel here?
Thank you for the insights. And I'm from School of Public Health here. I guess it's sort of building on the conversation that you guys have. I believe a lot of the public health crisis can be solved at the community level, especially for diabetes. Do you guys have any? I know that, you know, I'm very encouraged that Lilly philanthropical efforts are partnered with our school to develop community interventions. But is there any thoughts on, you know, further expanding that effort? Because, you know, a lot of the people who suffer diabetes are the people who don't have access to cares, right? So just some thoughts on that.
So if I could just make one comment, I can tell you about a project that we're working on currently out in California, looking at our Hispanic population that has very limited access to health care, as well as they tend to be migratory with regards to their work and inconsistency in just living in the same place. So we're working very closely with a research institute out in California to develop a model to look at how we can deliver healthcare in those kind of environments, which we see in many places around the world. And we're looking at a lot of opportunities around using community leaders, not necessarily healthcare providers or professionals. And so we have just finished training up our first round of people to go out into the community to test this model. But it also includes a lot of other things too, mobile units, you know, taking the healthcare professionals into the field. But we're trying to get a feel for what is the right model to deliver healthcare. And that's in the U.S.
And I used to say that, you know, diabetes prevention is a community health issue, not a clinical care issue. You know, there are efforts underway right here in Indianapolis. You know, find a sidewalk in Indianapolis. It is a tough thing to do. And Enrique mentioned it, Minnesota, which is the health, Minneapolis, which is the healthiest city in the United States by a variety of measures, has just miles and miles of sidewalks. Access to health care has been modified probably over 30 years. So I think there they've started to make a dent in some communities. And Enrique knows this because Kathleen participates. There are programs through the YMCA using simple community-based diabetes prevention efforts. Dara talked about Promontoris in the Latino-Latina community, which are not healthcare providers, but can make a huge impact on community health at very, very low cost.
So you're right that it needs to be approached by the community, but it needs to be a commitment by the community to be able to address it. A number of different companies, stakeholders need to play their role to make it happen.
Other questions? Teresa? Oh, okay.
I can talk. I'm just wondering if any of your innovation is going to target youth. Given David's point that really juvenile diabetes is not just type 1, and diabetes is not just hitting kids who have type 1. Type 2 is a big problem among the youth community, so will any of the innovation target, and especially when it comes to data or, you know, platforms that use phones or computers, this seems like a really great way to target youth and help with nutrition or health in that way. So do you have any plans for that?
Yeah, I can get started. We do, in fact, our next wave of innovation is very much looking at type 1 diabetes, and of course, as part of that, children is a huge part of where what we study and so forth. We have a nasal glucagon. Today, if you are taking insulin, you should have glucagon with you, but it's hard to administer, complex to put together. And I'm saying that Lilly is the owner of that product, and I can tell you it's very difficult. And I'm the president of Lilly Diabetes, so we are developing basically a non-injectable solution. We're also developing ultra-rapid insulin, which I think is going to be more and more important as part of a closed-loop system. That would also be used quite a bit by by children. And finally, we do have a pretty important study on with this is a medicine that I talked about earlier that has this benefit when it comes to cardiovascular risk. We're studying it also in type 1 diabetes. And I we need to see what the risk benefit is for that specific product. So that's a much bigger part of our portfolio today as we're thinking about it. The one area that I think you were also implying is, well, what about type 2 diabetes in children? And that area needs a lot more study, I'll be honest.
We really don't, but we can take one more question. We have time for one more question. We'll cheat.
All right. So you guys have been talking a lot about data. I just wanted to know if you can give us any more insight into, like, how comprehensive that data that you're collecting is. Is it just more specific markers as far as insulin, or are you looking to get data from, you know, the whole patient lifestyle, you know, neuropathy, wound care, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah. You know, it's an excellent question. I would say both. But as we think about our connected care ecosystem, the algorithms are based on basically a blood glucose measurement, insulin dosing, and basically the pattern of that specific patient, right? Now, we all know that there's great data out there, big data, about all of us. And there are many things that you can predict, right? But that's a different question that from the very specific solutions that we're developing when it comes to the two systems that we are introducing to the market.
I'll add, again, just from personal clinical experience, the use of aspirin as a preventative for people who've had a stroke or a heart attack as a way to prevent a second heart attack. It's commonly recommended for people with diabetes. A very simple use of EMR and data systems with an opt-out requirement that one system put in place, saying, is this patient with diabetes leaving the clinic with a recommendation for aspirin, yes or no? It's like putting a new app on your phone, install or not. So it wasn't an opt-in use of data. It was an opt-out. So you didn't have to do it. There's still freedom of choice. But to close the EMR, that patient, and use went up to about 98% of appropriate application. This was the Fairview Health System, again, in Minnesota. So I think that's the opportunity of simple data. Did you look at the feet?
Yes. How about from Roche's standpoint?
Yeah, and one thing I'd mention from Roche's perspective, we are casting a bit of a broader net, and you know, I think it's going to be progressive over time as we get better, more passive, less intrusive sensors for a lot of different biometrics. Clearly, activity levels is something that can be easily tracked. And one other area that I mentioned in particular is nutrition. So the aspect of food intake and carbohydrates, we're actually developing a food recognition app that could integrate in and help people with that critical variable as well.
That's terrific. Did you have a okay? Okay. Well, we are past our time. Thank you all. And please join me in thanking this terrific panelist. A great program, and we will definitely be continuing this. Our next Frameworks is on February 20th. It's going to be here. It's going to be on the subject of biomarkers. And for more information, go to our website. But please come back on the 20th of February. Thanks, everybody, very much for coming. I think our panelists will be here for a few moments if you have some additional questions for them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you.